right, all right. Man, I tell you, see that? Now, a day like today, that song is just going to just smack me right in the head and push me right out there. And I'm raring to go now, all right? That's right. All right. And the back end of the show, and now I'll calm down, okay? On the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Adriana Wong, who's a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California. And we're going to be talking about, she works on policing and economic issues at the ACLU. And we're going to be talking about recent exposures about basically how these police manuals that are always being used all over the country have advised illegal or questionable actions in going after immigrants in particular. Okay, so that's going to be the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be talking with Richard Falk, an international law and international relations scholar at Princeton University for 40 years. He's also up at UC Santa Barbara, and he's a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. And we're going to be talking with Richard about the situation in the Middle East right now, right? What's going on with that? And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to actually bring to you Sasha. Sasha's a student at Claremont Colleges, and she's one of the students who on Thursday, April 6th, was at the Claremont McKenna College and shut down a speech by the noted reactionary author Heather McDonald and just ran her butt out of that. She wasn't able to give the speech that she wanted to give, although she claims she did just as good by standing in a big, musty, empty room with windows all guarded and talking into God knows what. She's making a big thing out of that. But basically, she was run out and shut down. And the students at Claremont Colleges really need to be cheered for that. It's like it's a great thing to see when these kind of reactionaries are just shut down and run off. And joining us to talk about all this is Sasha, who was there. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. So what the hell did you do, huh?
Well, we found out about her speaking like a couple of days before, and a comrade of mine brought it to my attention, and we just decided to like get a few like big organizers and rally people because we knew that she was a white supremacist. We read a couple of her articles, and it didn't really take much to put it together. So we decided to make a Facebook event and then just coordinate with people. And basically just what we had done at the event was we got there like 2 hours before the event was supposed to start, and we blocked every single entrance of the building.
All right. There's some good thinking. Okay. That's very good. Now, when you talk about who this woman is, I want people to understand when you say she's a white supremacist, there's actually some things that she's produced, particularly this recent book on cops, right? Can you tell people about that?
Yeah. So she, like, I guess her, like, latest book is War on Cops. And she just kind of talks a lot about, like, black-on-black crime. And she uses that as a way to justify further policing in predominantly black and brown neighborhoods. She says that, like, the main problem is that, like, theft and all sorts of, yeah, just, like, crime in order to, like, argue that there is no such thing as racial-based policing, and it's just the fact that, like, low-income neighborhoods have higher rates of crime, and thus we need to, like, continue to police them and incarcerate people.
Then she also, she tries to set up this thing, too, it seems like, from things I've read, she tries to set up this thing where she's saying, it's all the stuff that you were saying, but it also, she adds on to this thing about that there's an attack on law and order, that people, that black people in particular, are making an attack on law and order, and people who support their standing up against the police are actually making that attack as well, an attack on law and order that makes everyone less safe. And it's just, it's really a demonization and a vilification of black people.
Yeah, for sure. And it absolutely doesn't even make sense if you understand, like, the history of police as an institution. It came out of catching runaway slaves. And yeah, it just does fundamentally doesn't make sense. The system of law and order was never meant to protect and serve the people.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, give people just a sort of like a really good picture of what happened, because I understand that this pig basically was left standing in an empty room, spirited off to an empty room. The windows are all blotted out, and she's left talking to herself, and they're trying to claim that this was that the students didn't really win, they didn't really succeed in shutting her up. But it seems, sure seems like to me that people did. And let's talk about what actually happened there.
Yeah, I generally would argue that it was successful because of what you said. And yeah, so I guess basically, like, she was already in the building because they get speakers to sleep inside the building. They have, like, some sort of guest room. So she was never escorted in. But then once it was probably, like, 100 people. It started with 100 people that got there. And then increasingly, I would say it got up to, like, 300 people. We just, like, were coordinated. They brought in campus security, which is unarmed. and they were just trying to like block us from blocking the entrances, but we can outnumber them very easily. So we just would move, and we would just look out where the campus security officers would go, because that's where they would try to escort people in who were trying to get into the event, or like student workers that were working at the event. And then we just would like coordinate with each other, get folks at the entrances and the back, like where the kitchen is, all sorts of weird entrances where people usually wouldn't walk in. And then after a couple hours, the police came and they decided not to arrest us. I don't know why. I guess like the college told them not to arrest us, but we were prepared to get arrested.
Well, you know, one of the things, actually, I mean, you think about the size of the people you had there. And from what I've seen of pictures and what I've read about it, it is actually what you're describing. People were very, very committed to preventing this person from spreading her lies and the trash that she talks. I mean, because, and people should know this, that, you know, it's not simply a book that she wrote that was an academic examination of the role of the police today. It actually was an assault against the truth of the police and their role in society. You know, that's something particular, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, one thing I'd like to ask you is that one of the things people should know, too, is that the LA Times ran an article talking about the event, but then they also, just a couple days later, ran an editorial that really came down and just smacked out at the students and really attacked the students for actually daring to stand up and do this, saying that there were better ways to do this, that they should have let her say this. And what would you say to the LA Times?
I don't really think white supremacists and fascists should have a platform at any given time. I think it's quite... Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to like have people are like put into question whether or not people's lives should be put at risk and people who are being dehumanized. So, yeah, I don't really think it's up for debate whether or not we should allow a fascist to speak. I think like other sorts of speakers, we should openly criticize them and debate them to show how their arguments are really poor and weak. But with people who are so explicitly putting an attack on movements like Black Lives Matter and all sorts of anti-fascist efforts, yeah, I don't think they should have a platform.
Yeah, that's a very important stand, and a very important stand for not only for people for you to take, but for people everywhere to learn from and to actually understand why that's important, because it's exactly what you're talking about. We don't need to hear what these Nazis have to say. Like, we have a lot of experience with them, you know? So this is, you know, come on now. And it is interesting, actually. Describe where she actually did end up giving the speech.
Well, it was inside the building because she couldn't get out. She was really scared. Like, she also wrote an article, and she actually described me in the article. And she was like, wow, like, this girl was so hysterical. She actually gave the talk inside of the building because she couldn't get out. And the room was empty, and you could, and even they were live streaming her talk, and you could actually hear people chant through her event or whatever.
That's great. You know, one of the things that's happened too, it's been all over Fox TV in the aftermath, and there's been all of these things that have been coming out. It indicates actually how worried they are about this kind of situation breaking out on campuses. And I thought this was an extremely important thing for people to popularize, you know, and it is actually, it is, in a sense, there is really a need for people to know that you guys did not stop, you know, and in the face of all this, that you stood up. And I think it's something that really needs to be spread around. The LA Times article actually also indicated some, you know, again, as I said, it indicated that the op-ed actually indicated that they're worried about a lot of this. And I wanted to ask you this, what was the university's response to this?
So Claremont McKenna College said that there would be punishment for the students who were involved. I don't know what that's going to look like. Folks are worried that folks who are seniors are not going to be able to walk but it's really difficult because a lot of folks who were out there, like, blocking the event were other students from the Claremont colleges, so you can't like persecute students from other universities. That university has to do it themselves, and none of the other universities really care. It's just McKenna that really wants to crack down. But I don't know, we're prepared for the worst, because they, particularly Claremont McKenna, is quite, they're not very sympathetic towards these sorts of things, because they have a lot of white supremacist students in their campuses, and they have a lot of people on their boards that really like these events and really like to sustain the order in place. Mm-hmm. So, we don't really know, but we're prepared.
Good. Very good. You know, one of the things I was going to ask is, you know, when you're talking about this, it's kind of in the days after, what's the response been on the campus amongst other students?
I would say generally people supported it. Like, a lot of people didn't even know that she was coming or what her politics were. But once folks who were there or like heard about it, like, understood what she stood for, then people were kind of like, okay, yeah, it makes sense that they like shut down this event. But there were a few people, quite a bit of people that were that like still continue to have the stance like, oh no, we should let them speak. I'm like, I'm interested. I want to hear what she has to say. But I think generally people supported it. I mean, definitely, because we were able to shut it down. Some people showed up.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And actually, I kept thinking as you're saying that, the response of we need to hear what she has to say, it's like those people that argue we need to hear what Hitler has to say. You know, it's sort of like,
yeah,
we haven't found this before. We don't know what's going on here. Yeah. It's very heavy. It's very heavy, I think, for people. And in terms of this in particular, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, if you didn't do this, if the students at Claremont had not done this, the idea of actually normalizing the fact that of what these fascists have to say. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that seemed to be very important.
Yeah, I guess there's like a weird, what I feel that around here is that there's a weird amnesia. I'm a history major, so I try not to forget how fascism is always on the corner, and it's always around us in order to sustain the capitalist economy. And so, yeah, like I think people here just think that fascism is a thing of the past and white supremacy is not an explicit form of fascism. And they think Trump is the only form of fascism we're seeing now, when in reality the fundamental establishment of this country is quite a fascist one. And so I guess like it's just disrupting this order, the order of normalization, that we think that just the person in power right now is a fascist, rather like all the dehumanization of the indigenous people of this land and black people and Latinx, Chicanx people who are being oppressed by the U.S. empire are constantly witnessing fascist violence towards them. So I think it's just kind of like agitating that and educating people on that sort of history and what's going on today and how people's lives are being affected by it.
And actually, I think really important in terms of, and we're going to have to wrap this up, but in really important in terms of what you've just been saying, there is this point too, though, that is very, you know, look, these people don't have a right to speak. They really don't. We are well aware of what it meant to have the Hitler regime. We were well aware of what it meant to see all these other various fascist regimes. And frankly, this is what they're trying to pull together. And the fact that you students actually stood up and stopped this is not something to be just sort of dismissed. This is a very, very important thing that needs to be spread and supported all over the place. So is there a way that people will be able to find out if you guys are being attacked, if you need support? Are you going to be able, is there a way they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, we'll probably be, if there'll be a campaign if we need help, we'll probably put out statements. Yeah, I'll reach out to you all if we can't get the word out.
All right, and even if you're still getting the word out, don't forget to let us know what's happening, all right?
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
All right, thank
take
you.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we were just talking with Sasha, and she was one of the students who was very active in that whole scene out there, and it was very important for people to support. And I wanted to bring on now someone who's also very active in this city, and this is Nikki. And Nikki's a member of Refuse Fascism in Los Angeles, and they are going to be talking about the 10 days that are coming up, 10 days of struggle to rock this regime, okay? All right. Now, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Nikki. Nikki is a member of the Los Angeles chapter of Refuse Fascism. And Nikki is here to talk with us about what Refuse Fascism has coming up in terms of 10 days of struggle. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Just to give people a sense, for those who don't know what Refuse Fascism is, tell them briefly what it is.
Well, first off, the main message that Refuse Fascism is trying to drive home is that in the Trump-Pence administration, this regime is fascist in nature, what we're facing. And anybody who is telling you any different is not fully coming to grips with the severity and the gravity of the situation.
Let me ask you this, and I think that's important what you were just saying, and I want people to understand Refuse Fascism is actually an organization that sees an extreme urgency in the moment we're in right now. Talk about that.
We're calling for people to organize and join mass contingents of many thousands of people under the banner of no, in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept the fascist America. We're looking to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. I mean, make no mistake, the Trump-Pence regime, the whole thing, every cabinet post, every executive order, every tweet, it's a link in the chain of a fascist government and worldview under the signboard of America First. And every immigrant family being ripped apart, every refugee turned back to war-torn countries, every pipeline approved, every river despoiled, every denial of proven science, of established facts, of truth is killing more people now and will cost millions more lives. This is poison to the air, the water, the earth, and to the conscience of the people. Millions of people righteously abhor this and are, you know, engaging in resistance, but whether or not we can stop the dire threat of this regime to humanity means recognizing and acting on the understanding that history has shown that fascism must be stopped before it becomes too late.
Tell me this. Given what you're saying, you guys have taken up a whole stand that there's a specific urgency to the situation we're in right now, and you've called for 10 days of struggle all the way across the country. Everywhere people are looking at this regime and sick of it or worried about it and want to stop it, you've called for people to come together in massive numbers of people and take up 10 days of struggle. What are these 10 days of struggle?
Thank you for asking. I mean, right now, thousands of people must be organized. Their creativity and their determination and their anguish, it must be unleashed so that this April marks a decisive advance in the struggle to put a stop to the fascist regime by driving it out. People need to see the message, our call, no, everywhere, and learn that this organization is working for the time when millions act together, filling the streets of cities and towns day after day and night after night, declaring this whole regime illegitimate.
And so what do you want to see come out of these 10 days?
The 10 days are April 22nd to May 1st, the end of the first 100 days of the Trump-Pence regime. They can and must become a big leap in a movement to drive this fascist regime from office. The stakes are nothing less than the future of humanity and the planet. Over the course of 10 days, hundreds of thousands of people will pour into the streets in important and righteous protests in Washington, D.C., and cities across the country, aimed at three key fronts of the Trump-Pence regime's reactionary program: the attacks on science, the denial of human-caused climate change, and the attacks on immigrants and, more broadly, working people as a whole. RefuseFascism.org endorses these protests, and we're calling on people to attend and to build and magnify them. These 10 days must involve people from every section of society here and internationally acting together, standing up, and getting into the streets infused with the spirit of basta ya, enough, enough, doing so with the moral conviction and the fire to stand with the diversity of people here and around the world. So on April 22nd, we're calling people to stand with scientists against the Trump-Pence regime, denying and attacking science, which is a method by which humanity can understand reality and which is essential to progress. That's going to be on Saturday, the 22nd, and on April 24th, that's Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day and also the International Holocaust Remembrance Day. So we're calling on you to join us to commemorate these massive and horrific tragedies and attempted genocides against racial and ethnic minorities at the hands of despotic regimes, pay our respects to the millions who lived through these horrors and millions who were slaughtered, and say, in the name of humanity, never again. And on April 29th, we're calling on people to stand against the Trump-Pence regime's devastation of the climate and environment, which, without exaggeration, imperils life on Earth. Finally, we've got May 1st. We're calling on people of all nationalities to join in protest to stop the demonization, attacks, and deportations of immigrants that is at the reactionary heart of this Nazi-like fascism that the Trump-Pence regime is perpetrating. We and March and Rally LA, National Congreso Latino, Red Mexicana, and many other organizations are calling for this to go much further and to be much broader than just a march. We're calling for a nationwide strike. No work, no school, and no purchases. We're saying shut it down. We've got to bring this to a halt and say, no, this regime is unacceptable, and we're going to be calling out millions more to the streets to stay in the streets until we can drive it out.
Damn, man, that sounds great. So one final thing. How do people get in touch with you if they want to join this or find out more about it?
We're at RefuseFascism.org. Our phone number, if you want to drive out this Trump-Pence regime now, please call us today at 917-407-1286.
All right, Nikki, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, take care now. All right, and that was all about the upcoming 10 days of struggle to really go up against this, to just knock a hole in this Trump regime, to really bring people out together to stand up against this. And we've got to start, actually really have got to start changing the whole scene here now, all right? And we're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be right back to talk with Richard Falk, so stay tuned.
What is a blueocracy? A blueocracy is where we be, who we be. The blueocracy is where you must be.
All right, the blueocracy, and that's from the World Saxophone Quartet. All right, if you've been paying attention about what's going on in the world these days, the last couple of weeks, you've got to have your head spinning. You've got to be thinking about this. What the hell are we up against? And just this morning, as I was coming over to work, I thought, I'm listening to the radio, and they start talking about how the situation in the world is in dire straits, poised on the edge of massive upheaval. And listening to the news, the U.S., then they were talking about the U.S. threats to North Korea. They were actually talking about all this stirring up the danger of nuclear war. They talked about Trump's assertion that U.S. rights to take out their opponents wherever and whenever they want to. And sisters and brothers, just to be brief here, these are very dangerous times, and we've got to stand up and do something about this, because dangerous times can lead to opportunity. They can also lead to tremendous suffering, all right? So let's get into making the first one happen, the opportunity to change this world once and for all. And here to talk with us about all this is Richard Falk. Now, Richard hasn't been on the show for a while, but I've always enjoyed talking with him. It's been a while. I think the last time we talked with him, he was in Turkey. Richard's an international law and international relations scholar who taught at Princeton University for 40 years. He's also been teaching at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he's the author or co-author of 20 books and the editor or co-editor of another 20 volumes. In 2008, the United Nations Human Rights Council appointed him to a 6-year term as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, I second that, man. I'm really glad we're getting together on this. I want to jump into it because I want to take this as far as we can on this, all right? And the situation in the world, like I said, I just heard all this stuff about North Korea, and they're talking about the threat of war and what's going to go on, the U.S. pushing one way, and the North Koreans saying that they'll attack the U.S. where the U.S. lives, all this kind of stuff that's going on. What's your assessment of the situation and the dangers posed in the world by the showdown between the Trump regime and North Korea?
I think it is a horribly frightening moment in contemporary world history, and it's a moment where it is a real tragedy, not only for Americans, but for the peoples of the world, that we have the most irresponsible, unqualified leader that one can possibly imagine. It's a situation that is subject to these abrupt shifts as the Trump flip-flops on major issues in the past week showed, and there is, I think, underneath all this, a reassertion of influence by the so-called national security state or the deep state, which was disappointed by the defeat of Hillary Clinton, who had looked toward a more confrontational geopolitics, which seemed to be resisted by Trump during his campaign. But now, gradually, he's embraced that worldview, which is terribly dangerous, and is a danger that's accentuated by his personality and political style.
And I would add to that the needs of U.S. imperialism, quite frankly.
That's what he's out there for. That's all part of the, I think the agenda of the national security state or the deep state is precisely that global imperial agenda, what I call the global domination project. And that was, I think, seen to be in jeopardy by the Trump campaign, which appeared to be taking this kind of neo-isolationist approach of withdrawing from commitments around the world. And you had the unprecedented occurrence of the Republican members of this national security elite signing an open letter several months before the election, indicating they were abandoning the Republican Party and supporting Hillary Clinton because she understood the security imperatives of an imperial America.
Let me ask you this, Richard, because I actually, this deep state is something we could talk about again and again, and I actually have a whole different understanding of that. I don't really uphold that, you know, in my own thinking, but I'd rather, you know, pursue where we're going to go on this overall and then talk about that at some other point. So let's talk about this, the U.S. attack on ISIS in Afghanistan, the mother of all bombs dropped. Now, here's the U.S. Imperials have been arguing all this time about how they're so opposed, especially when they went in and they attacked Syria and they attacked the Air Force, the air base there, and saying that they were just so outraged by what had happened to the Syrian people, the chemical warfare against the Syrian people by their own regime is what they're saying. And I guess that's also still left, you know, up in the air in terms of what actually did really happen. But there's this whole point of, then they come out with, and all the things that have all the things they come out with when they're trying to claim the banner of we operate as the good guys, they come out with this mother of all bombs and unleash it on Afghanistan. Let's talk about that somewhat.
Well, the official version here, again, I don't know how much to trust its accuracy, but it claims that this was a necessary military operation due to the ISIS using a cave complex that could only be affected militarily by this kind of weapon. Whether that's a real explanation or whether this is just a kind of global show of force, a kind of militarist hubris, it's very different. Maybe a combination of all of that. And Trump has been saying he's given total authorization, in his words, to use American military power in ways that the Obama people failed to do.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me, though, is that, and in particular, when he was talking about, in fact, when he did this, when he lined up the bombing mission against Syria, I mean, they fired, you know, what, 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles at the Syrian airfield at Al-Shayrat, I think it is.
Al-Shayrat.
Yeah, yeah. Now, they fired 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles there, and they painted it as a humanitarian mission. You know, and it just really strikes me. It's, you know, the same thing in terms of they're talking about how they're going after the bad guys, and that they're going after the bad guys ends up being really unleashing more bombs, more attacks on people of the world. Let's talk about that in terms of...
Well, it's all part of this militarist reflex. When something happens that you want to oppose, the only thing that our political imagination seems able to grasp is doing something equally or worse militarily than what the other side is accused of doing. Here, the justification is that this will deter in the future the Assad regime from using chemical weapons, but it's doubtful that they were, in fact, used by the Assad regime in the original attack on the town of Khan Sheikhoun on April 4th, which was the justification for the air attack that the U.S. launched against Shayrat. So the whole thing is very much embedded in this militarist framing of conflict around the world, despite the fact that military power has a very poor record of controlling political outcomes ever since 1945. In almost every major political conflict, and for the U.S., the Vietnam War should have been the dramatic demonstration of this, the side that was weaker militarily prevailed politically. And that's the great unlearned lesson of the last 75 years.
You know, one of the things that struck me when I'm reading about this and trying to figure out, you know, what's going on and just following it, and it really struck me that you know, as the U.S. is doing all this, as they're talking about all this, that actually what they were in fact doing, I mean, you know, they were arguing that they were standing with the, on the side of the people. They were arguing that they were standing up for human rights and for, you know, no government should be allowed to do this. And then you think about what the U.S. has done in Yemen, what it's done in Iraq, what it's done in Syria itself, what it just did with this mega bomb in Afghanistan, and the audacity and the glaring contradiction of the reality of the U.S. imperialists in the world and what they're putting forward and how they're actually going on in attacking the world and trying to, unleashing all these assaults on the world, but at the same time trying to do it as under the banner of we're taking care of the people.
Yeah, no, it's a moral outrage. I mean, we do all these terrible things and are responsible for killing millions of civilians all over the world, and yet we still try to cling to the high moral ground. It's unprecedented hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the imperial ideology that allows the government to gain sufficient support that it can continue with this destructive program.
Richard Falk is an international law and international relations scholar who taught at Princeton University for 40 years. He's also taught at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the author or co-author of 20 books and the editor or co-editor of another 20 volumes. In 2008, the United Nations Human Rights Council, UNHRC, appointed him to a 6-year term as a United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967.
Do you see this element of, I'd like to dig into this a little bit more, this element of the U.S. actually flexing their muscles in the region, not just sort of like making these attacks for their own benefits or something, but actually flexing their muscles in relation to other imperial powers, in relation to, you know, some of these reactionary fundamentalists there and, you know, that kind of thing, of the U.S. actually flexing their muscle and saying, this is our turf and we're going to make you agree to
that. Yeah, and as I've been saying, it's a militarist flexing of muscles in a period in history where military superiority no longer works to control the flow of history. The anti-colonial war showed that the weaker side in the end prevails, and that's happened over and over again in the last 75 years. Yet we've invested so heavily in the military machine that we don't know how to think outside that box. And so, as you say, we're flexing our muscles by showing that we have the biggest bombs in the world, that we have the most destructive military capabilities. We can fly drones anywhere and destroy targets throughout the planet. It's a complete militarist political imaginary that we're being victimized by at the present time. And this isn't just attributable to Trump. It is exaggerated, perhaps, by the crudeness of the way he governs and talks. But it would have been not very different had Hillary Clinton prevailed in last November.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go to here. Even if Syria did launch this attack, which again, you know, even if you give what the U.S. is saying, okay, fine, Syria launched it. This is still, and that would be a clear violation of international law, given the use of chemical warfare and the rest of this. But this doesn't mean that the U.S. or anyone else has the right to actually then go and bomb Syria, right?
Right. There's no authorization by the U.N. Security Council and no justification in international law for a recourse to force in situations other than self-defense. And whatever this attack was, it was part of an ongoing civil struggle within Syria. It certainly can't be a ground for attacking. And they don't even claim that it was self-defense. They claim that what they're doing is enforcing the norm against using chemical weapons.
Mm-hmm. Now, the U.S. actually violated international law and the U.N. Charter in bombing the airport there in Syria, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting point there.
No, but you have to appreciate that we've been violating international law consistently over the last several decades. And unfortunately, in the war peace area particularly, international law has been more and more marginalized. And again, I wouldn't say that this is just a phenomena associated with the Trump presidency. It was true during Obama's years. The drone attacks all over the world were also violations of international law, and unilateral claims that we can decide who to attack and where to attack whenever we want.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me something. It's actually, and this is going to have to be the last question, and it's something I wanted to read you. It's something I think you said, and I'd really like to, you know, hear your comments on this, because all the things that we're talking about, the various invasions the U.S. is carrying out, the role it's playing in attacking the people in these countries, and the whole setup of things in terms of really pushing in a way to, it's part of this sort of, we're really on the prowl now. The U.S. saying we're really on the prowl now, and really, you know, this is our world, and we're going to take it over. And this is the whole Trump regime and the Trump, you know, idea around this. Now, you said something once, and I thought it was really important. And you said, certainly in my lifetime, with the possible exception of the Great Depression, America has not been tested as it is now. Maybe not since the American Civil War has so much been at stake and put at risk. And that's extremely important. Let's talk about that for a minute going out.
Yes, I would affirm that. I think that the resilience of the American political process is very much at stake, and it depends on the vitality of popular resistance to challenge the regime that we now have in power, which is reinforced, unfortunately, by a very irresponsible and reactionary Congress and an increasingly reactionary Supreme Court. So there's no checks and balances operating at a time when we have an autocratic leader that has the pretensions of speaking on behalf of the what he conceives to be the public, the people. That is the formula of fascism. The leader, only the leader can interpret the voice of the people. And therefore, we are in a period where there's a encounter between popular resistance that seeks to restore democracy and human rights for the people of this country and to abandon militarist imperialism overseas, and this autocratic, reactionary, plutocratic leadership. That's where we're at, it seems to me.
All right, Richard Falk, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Well, thank you, Michael. Sure. Good to be with you.
Yeah, talk to you again soon, man. Take care.
Good. Bye.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Richard Falk, an international law and international relations scholar at Princeton University for 40 years. He's a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a former United Nations special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
1, 2, 3.
Live in a political world, love don't have any place. We're living in times where men commit crimes, crime don't have a face. We live in a political world, icicles hanging down. Wedding bells ring and angels sing and clouds cover up the ground. We live in a political world where mercy walks the plank. Life is in mirrors, death disappears up steps to the nearest bank. We live in a political world. Courage is the thing of the past. The house of 100 children on one and the next day could be your last.
All right, welcome back. That's Political World, all right? Political World from the album Chimes of Freedom, the songs of Bob Dylan, and it's the Carolina Chocolate Drops, all right? So there you go. Go look them up, Carolina Chocolate Drops. All right, just yesterday I was reading the LA Times, and I came across this story about yet another really vicious, vicious assault on immigrant people. And it was talking about basically the police manuals that are basically opening the doors for all kinds of attacks on, arrests of, laying the ground for deportation, all of these things against immigrants. And there was a person that was quoted in the article. Her name is Adriana Wong, and she's a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California. And I'm really looking forward to talking to her because she seemed to be saying quite a few things that are important and people need to hear in relation to this. Adriana, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's jump into this. What's the story with all these, the story here is that suddenly all these manuals, people are uncovering all these police manuals that were produced by one company, and they seem to be arguing for ways to really figure out how can you entrap, telling cops how you can entrap immigrants and end up getting them locked up and as one step in towards deportation. What's the story with all this?
Sure. So for some time, we've been hearing that in some police departments, not all, but some, officers were holding people in the field, prolonging their detention in order to transfer them to the custody of immigration authorities. We wanted to know a little bit more about that, so we started investigating the internal policies of these police departments. And through that, we discovered that a number of them share a standardized policy purchased from a private company that purports to authorize officers to arrest people for federal immigration offenses.
Can you expand on that a little bit more? Because it was really shocking, some of the things that they were saying. And even in terms of, like, there was a whole question of how do you ID an illegal immigrant that they spoke to?
Right. So the policies suggest that local police can arrest people for a few specific federal immigration crimes. But the bases that they identify as suspicion for those crimes are really quite broad. They include things like limited English proficiency. They suggest that local police officers can look at the immigration documentation of people that they encounter in the field. And even though they purport to say that officers can arrest for specific crimes, really what they're saying is that officers can't detain people and maybe even arrest people based on a generalized suspicion about their immigration status.
How has that been carried out? Has it been carried out broadly now?
Thankfully, most police departments that we've spoken to have said that they do not enforce this policy. But as I mentioned before, we have seen some actual examples of people being detained in the field and their detention being prolonged for transfer to immigration authorities. And that's something that the policy that we're talking about suggests is legal. And of course, we take issue with that.
Now, I thought I read somewhere that there was actually 3,000 police agencies have actually taken advantage of this thing.
I had not heard that. I would not be surprised. The company that wrote the policy has quite a wide reach. We did not send public records requests to every police department in California, but we found the policy in at least 9 jurisdictions that we investigated, and we know that the policy exists in other states as well.
Now, one of the things here is just to give people a really good sort of sense of this, so it's in their heads, it's in their gut, that they know what's going on. What has it meant for immigrants so far? What's the actual toll that it's taken?
Well, what I think it does is really compromise the trust between immigrant communities or, people in communities of color where their friends and family may be immigrants, the trust between them and the police. Because as long as this policy is on the books, people can't be sure that they can call the police for help, that they can present themselves as witnesses to crimes, that sort of thing, without the police then looking at them, assessing, how well they speak English or any other factors and saying, hey, maybe we want to take you in now because we suspect something about your immigration status. So it's really not good for public safety or for community trust.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Adriana Wong, who is a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California, where she works on policing and economic issues. One of the things that struck me is that it really reminded me of all the things that I've read about the various fascist states, particularly in the beginning of these states, and the kinds of things that when they went after certain parts of the population, when the fascists went after certain parts of the population, there was this whole demonization of them that allowed them to, that actually encourage these kinds of things, or was built on the kinds of things of, well, we're just making sure that you're not illegal, or we just have this procedure that we have to do. And this thing really stunk of that, including even the thing about the police and are the police really there to help immigrants, or are they there as part of the enforcement of this whole rotten scene that's, that's coming down on immigrants, people of color, other people? It's just like there's a huge shift going on in this country, and I couldn't help but think of this in relation to that.
Right, absolutely. It definitely blurs the lines of who are the police intending to protect and serve? And beyond that, I think, going to your point, it's really troubling to suggest that we live in perhaps a show-me-your-paper state because the policy suggests that officers should be demanding and looking at people's documentation to assess whether or not they are authorized to be here by immigration authorities. And that's also not a great position for our community members to be in.
Now, where did this company come from that actually has developed these handbooks?
So it's a private company, and my understanding is that they have representatives and offices in various parts around the country.
And one last question. What are the ACLU's demands and changes that the ACLU wants to see? What are your demands and changes, and how are you pursuing this?
Well, we think this policy is extremely misleading and will lead to racial profiling and illegal arrests, so we want it off the books. We think that Lexapol, the private company that put out the policy, should issue a notice to everybody who's purchased the policy, you know, warning them that it will give rise to potential liability and constitutional violations, telling them, you know, you should eliminate this, possibly providing them with a replacement that comports more with the law and with principles of good policing. And we think that the police departments that have adopted these policies should, you know, immediately get rid of them as well.
You know, one of the things, I was just looking at my notes, and one of the things I can't leave this interview without asking you, because there actually is, there's this point about what exactly is being told to, you know, to people. And what, I think the company is Lexapol, right? And there's this whole idea that they've actually even talked about basically zeroing in on whether or not immigrants speak, or the people that the police come up on, zeroing in on whether or not they speak proper English, or they seem to be able to understand English words. And it seems to me that that's a pretty heavy situation that they're doing. If they come up and they talk to somebody and somebody's speaking in another language, or they can't understand everything that the cop is saying, that then opens the door for them to be hauled away to a jail now, but to a camp later.
Yeah, I myself am the child of immigrants, and growing up, you know, I had close family members. All the adults in my life really were learning English, and the idea that if at any time we were stopped by a police officer, you know, the fact that they were still learning English could have been a basis for us to be detained or even to be transferred to immigration authorities or even arrested is truly frightening.
All right, so where do things stand now, and how do people find out more about this?
Sure. So we have posted the letter that we sent to Lexapol outlining our legal arguments, as well as a blog about why we are concerned about the policy on our website, aclusocal.org. We encourage everybody to go ahead and look at it. And, you know, this really ties into our nationwide People Power campaign. We are encouraging people to approach their local police departments, ask to see the policies so they can uncover problematic policies like this one. And so, you know, you can find out more about that campaign on our website as well. And we invite everyone to contact us on how they can get involved.
All right, Adriana Wong, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Adriana Wong, a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California, where she works on policing and economic issues, and she's been involved in lawsuits against the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and private prison contractors. She recently helped expose the police manuals that advised illegal or questionable actions be taken against immigrants. All right? All right, we've got some time left, so I'm going to play something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, that has a special relevance to the March for Science and the Climate March that are coming up soon. It also has special relevance for the whole situation in the world today and what's facing humanity. This is a clip called "The Capitalists Are Not Fit Caretakers of the Earth," and it's from the talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About.
Let's look a little more fully at the history of this system. Its crimes all over the world, as well as within the U.S. itself. Look at what their system is doing to the earth, how it is wrecking the environment. In places like Brazil, as well as in places in Africa and Asia, there are beautiful rainforests full of a rich diversity of species which are being torn down and destroyed by the ever-hungry engine of this system. These are not just short-term effects. This has a long-term effect on the environment, not just in those places, but all over the world. And it has an effect on the people, too. For example, in Brazil, indigenous people, whose way of life was based on living in the rainforest, wake up one day to see a bulldozer knocking down the trees 100 yards from where they've always lived. And what's the result of this? Many of them can no longer go on living the way they were before. And one of the things that happens is many of the young women go into the cities in Brazil to become prostitutes because that's the only way they can survive. And now we have people like Bush and them talking about drilling for oil in Alaska. Once again, hungry for oil without regard to the environment or the effects on the people for generations to come. At the same time, they're breaking or refusing to sign agreements on the environment, on global warming, backing out of these agreements if they made them in the first place. Once again, these are not just so-called isolated incidents they always tell us about, the few rotten apples. This is what they have done and are doing to the environment throughout the U.S. and all over the world. To take one outrageous example of this, within the memory of many people alive today, the U.S. government carried out testing of nuclear weapons, bringing contamination and poisoning of people even inside this country itself, along with the devastation and the driving out of the whole population of the Bikini Islands in the Pacific during the late 1940s and 50s. Because of this nuclear testing in their home was no longer livable for them. Now, recently I was reading an essay called Disarming Images about an exhibit of art for nuclear disarmament, which was held in the early 1980s. And I noticed that the author of this essay points out that according to the dictionary, Webster's Third International Dictionary, the name bikini given to the bathing suit comes from comparing, quote, the effects of a scantily clad woman to the effects of an atomic bomb, unquote. When you think about this, and you think about the horrendous death, destruction, mutilation, and suffering alive before dying that was caused by the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan, and what would result from the much more powerful nuclear weapons these monsters have today. When you think about all that, and you think about the reasons for naming the bikini after all that, and what kind of view of women this promotes, do you need any other proof of how sick this system is, and how sick is the dominant culture it produces and promotes? And speaking again of the environment, now they are not only gutting environmental protection laws and safeguards in the U.S. itself, they are insisting that governments everywhere in the world do the same. They are declaring that even limited attempts at environmental protection are an unfair obstacle to free trade. In other words, it is in the way of their endless rampage for more profit, without regard or consideration to the cost for humanity, in this generation and for generations to come. This system and those who rule over it are not capable of carrying out economic development to meet the needs of the people now, while balancing that with the needs of future generations and requirements of safeguarding the environment. They care nothing for the rich diversity of the earth and its species, for the treasures this contains, except when and where they can turn this into profit for themselves. As our party's draft program makes clear, these people are not fit to be the caretakers of the earth.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with "The Capitalists Are Not Fit Caretakers of the Earth," from the talk Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can find that on the Revolution channel on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and go to the Revolution channel, and you'll find a lot from Bob Avakian, and especially this talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Now, there's a couple things that I want to read on, because we are looking to amp this show up a lot harder and a lot heavier and a lot broader, all right? And I want to share this with you. I know a lot of you are anguished about the times we're in. The war on Syria is just the latest example, and many of you are part of the resistance. You listen to and support The Michael Slate Show because you want to understand the world and impact it. Now, we're calling for volunteers to work on the show to not only continue to bring the kind of programming that people need in these times, but to improve and expand the show and its reach. We need people to help with researching, guests and content, getting the show out on the internet, especially social media, sound editing of recorded shows for broadcast on stations outside of LA, transcribing selected interviews for print and web publication, outreach and publicity. All of this you can play a vital role in. You can do this from anywhere with an internet connection. So write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. You can also send a direct message on Twitter or Facebook, all right? All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today. Sasha from Claremont Colleges in Southern California, who stood up against Heather McDonald, a fascist fake scholar who was scheduled to speak there and spread her poison and wasn't able to do it because the students shut her down. All right. I also want to thank Nikki, a member of Refuse Fascism in Los Angeles, who spoke with us about 10 days of resistance. I also want to thank Richard Falk, an international law and international relations scholar at Princeton University for 40 years and a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, and a former United Nations special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. I also want to thank Adriana Young, who is a staff attorney at the ACLU in Southern California, where she works on policing and economic issues. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, it's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, that's it for this week. And we're going to go out now with, once again, just a song that just keeps really beating in my head and beating at my heart. It's called Amazing Disgrace from the World Saxophone Quartet. Talk to you again next week.
Amazing disgrace when they brought us to this godforsaken place. They raped our mothers, incarcerated our fathers, stole all the land. But in spite of all that, everything will be okay. And that's a natural fact. But nobody will never, they will never be free until they free me and we.